It's Thursday, February 27, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Big decisions were made yesterday, and those decisions will reverberate long after the day itself is forgotten. First of all, in Arizona, Governor Jan Brewer vetoed legislation passed by both houses of the Arizona legislature that would have granted explicit religious liberty protections to business people, to churches and foundations, under the very heated context of same-sex marriage looming over the state of Arizona as well as over the entire nation. Now, as she vetoed the bill yesterday, the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, did so under enormous political pressure and outright economic pressure as well. For instance, the National Football League that is scheduled to hold the 2015 Super Bowl in Phoenix announced that it might reconsider and go to its second choice, Tampa, if Governor Brewer were to sign the legislation into law. Companies like Apple Computers and Microsoft and many others announced that they would reconsider their business with the state and in the state if Governor Brewer signed the bill into law. Furthermore, a national fury of a great deal of controversy about the bill, largely based in a misrepresentation of its actual wording and its intent, put the governor in the position that when she returned from the National Governors Conference in Washington, it was almost a sure thing that she would veto the bill. And veto the bill she did. She said in her veto statement, quote, "I have not heard of one example in Arizona where business owners' religious liberty has been violated. The bill is broadly worded and could result in unintended and negative consequences," end quote. The Washington Post reported those statements, but let's think about it for just a moment. She says that she hasn't heard of even one example in Arizona where business owners' religious liberty has been violated. Well, that might be true in Arizona for right now, but it isn't true in New Mexico, which is a bordering state. And she knows full well that a photographer in that state has faced sanctions for refusing to serve as a photographer for a same-sex wedding ceremony. So what we're talking about here is not the fact that this is just a hypothetical or unrealistic danger to religious liberty in Arizona, but you have a governor under political and economic pressure who simply did what most expected her to do. She vetoed the bill. She did so with a good number of prominent Republicans calling upon her to veto the bill, including Arizona United States Senator John McCain, including former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Those two men, by the way, of course, were the last two presidential nominees of the Republican Party. In other words, there was an establishment push against this bill, and that tells us a great deal about how the moral shift on the issue of homosexuality has now reached the point that a bill like this instantly becomes a matter of national and international controversy. And here's what's really crucial. This bill, in terms of its actual language, stipulates in a specific way what is already arguably within the law of Arizona. What we have here is something larger than appears on its face. What we have here is a major shift in terms of the negotiation of liberties in our society. Now, from a Christian worldview perspective, we have to recognize that no liberty is absolute in terms of its application when it comes into collision with other competing liberties. And this is a major issue that is very much a focus of the United States in its founding era, of our Declaration of Independence, and of the Constitution. That's why we have a separation of powers. That's why we have a government of laws and not of men. That's why we try to distribute authority and responsibility. And that's why we have mediating institutions and governing institutions in order to adjudicate these kinds of rights. What we're talking about here is something entirely new in human history. What we have here is what I described in the speech I gave at Brigham Young University earlier this week as the rise of erotic liberty at the expense of religious liberty. In other words, the demand of people that their erotic and romantic activities, orientations, and relationships be sanctioned is now in our society on the ascent. It now is considered dominant even when it runs into collision with one of the most basic human freedoms that the United States was founded upon, and that is religious liberty. In this entire controversy, perhaps the saddest thing in my view has been how many Christians have been willing to give away religious liberty and to throw other Christians to Caesar, effectively throwing them to the legal lions, by suggesting that this bill would discriminate. Well, every law discriminates. Every government discriminates. And the government that just said it will not discriminate on this basis, well, this governor discriminates on other grounds. As a matter of fact, when you look at what's going on here on the issue of same-sex marriage, you'll note that not all human relationships are here being sanctioned. Not all romantic relationships are here being given approval. It's specifically right now same-sex marriage. In other words, this state, all 50 states, and the United States government still discriminates on the matter of marriage. It just at this point isn't discriminating between the same-sex and opposite-sex couplings. That's an entire issue for our discussion in terms of the future of civilization, but at this point, it's important to see that erotic liberty is on the march, and religious liberty is very much in danger. And it's in danger among the very people who actually have counted upon it and have depended upon it, even for the existence of their Christian ministries. And that's why a severe wake-up call is going to come sooner or later, especially to those who have naively believed that religious liberty in this kind of situation is not threatened. It might not be threatened for an individual in a certain place at a certain time in a certain business right now. It is threatened for others. Just ask the bakers and the florists and the photographers and others who have found themselves in this situation. How long will it be before it's the singers and the writers? How long will it be before it's others who are going to be in the situation in which they're told they cannot refuse to do business in this context, even if it violates their religious liberty, or they have to go out of business? How long before a kosher deli is told that it has to serve a KKK rally? If that sounds absurd, just recognize what we're talking about here in terms of the bill that was vetoed yesterday by the governor of Arizona. That situation would have been unthinkable just a matter of a few months ago, not just a few years ago. Finally, before leaving this issue, I want to go back to two very salient points. One of the things we're going to have to watch is the fact that when a moral revolution takes place, there are people who simply embrace it all of a sudden as if it has always been self-evidently true. Just consider what's going on among some leading Republicans who now seem to say, I don't know what we're concerned about here. Problem? I don't see a problem, when even the platform upon which they ran for president stipulated that this is a problem. Then you also see what happens with business. And this is where you have to wonder if Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels didn't have it right when they said, or are said to have said, that when the time comes to hang the capitalists will compete to sell the rope. In other words, when you have business interests interested only in the matters that interest a business, you'll see that these moral concerns are quite quickly transformed into something else. And so what you have with Apple and the NFL and others is now grandstanding on a moral plane in order to say, Governor, if you sign this law, we're going to take our business elsewhere. And one thing to note in this, of course, is the National Football League, a league that has itself hardly been open to the issue of homosexuality, that has, at least even until now, not one openly gay player, that is telling the governor of a state in Arizona that if she signs this bill, they'll try to move the Super Bowl. When you talk about hypocrisy, it's hard to come up with a more classic example than that. But Governor Brewer's veto of that legislation yesterday wasn't the only major decision. It wasn't even the only major decision on the related issue of same-sex marriage. As a matter of fact, a federal judge in San Antonio, Texas, struck down the Lone Star State's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. This was the latest in a long line now of these decisions that have come down since the Windsor decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court just last June. As Manny Fernandez of the New York Times reports, Judge Garcia's ruling will have no immediate effect on gay and lesbian couples wishing to marry in Texas. That's because the judge issued a stay on his decision while the state appeals to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. By the way, this judge, Judge Orlando L. Garcia of the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas in San Antonio, was appointed to the federal bench by President Bill Clinton in 1994. One of the interesting things about his decision is that it basically follows almost boilerplate the similar decisions handed down by other U.S. federal district court judges since last June. But in his decision, he has a very interesting history of the issue with respective states. From his decision, I read, quote, since 2003, states continue to have polarizing views on the issue of same-sex marriage. That is, most states have either legalized same-sex marriage or passed a constitutional amendment or other legislation prohibiting same-sex marriage in civil unions. End quote. Let me stop there for a moment and say that what the judge here is citing is the fact that there is hardly a state that is neutral on the question. The states have either legalized same-sex marriage or they have taken legislative or constitutional action to prevent same-sex marriage. But back to his decision, he writes, to this day, six states have legalized same-sex marriage through state court decisions. Those are the states of California, Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New Mexico. Eight states have passed same-sex marriage legislation. They're the states of Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, and Vermont. And three states have legalized same-sex marriage through popular vote, Maine, Maryland, and Washington, end quote. Well, if you look closely at what the judge is saying here, 8 states, through their legislatures, have endorsed same-sex marriage. 6 states, through the judiciary, have done the same thing. Only 3 states have done so by action of citizens. That's over against over 25 states that, by action of their own citizens, have adopted constitutional amendments or similar measures to prevent same-sex marriage. It's a very interesting admission in the midst of his argument. But later in his argument, he gets right to the fact that he, like all the judges before him since last June, have cited Justice Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion in the Windsor case as the reason for the judgment that the judge has made. He cites it especially in pages 40 and following of his decision, and he cites it in the particular way of saying that, as Justice Kennedy had argued, according to the Windsor decision, the state of Texas is violating the constitutional rights of some of its citizens by not allowing them to marry when it allows others to marry. But of course, my point and retort is simply this. Even now, even if this judge's decision is held up and is ratified, or if the Supreme Court of the United States makes same-sex marriage legal coast to coast, every single one of these governments will still discriminate on the basis of marriage. It will just change the basis of that discrimination. This is one of the most insidious issues in this conversation from a Christian worldview perspective. Words are very meaningful. They're very important. The word discrimination is, in the views of most people, automatically a negative word. And usually, as it's used in our cultural context, it is a negative word. It says something that we don't want to do. We don't want to be discriminatory. We don't want to discriminate against people, because what we imply by that is that the discrimination will be wrong, based in some bad judgment, based upon some very suspicious form of reasoning. But the fact is that even as we say we don't want to discriminate, we discriminate against what discrimination might mean. In other words, all discriminate means is to clarify, and in clarifying, to make distinctions. And the law will continue to do that, as will every sane person. Because any moral code, no matter how liberal or conservative, requires discrimination. It's a question of whether or not the discrimination is righteous and just, equitable, and based in what is actually true and reasonable. That's why the state of Texas, or the United States government, or any government for that matter, continues to discriminate. We count on our government discriminating. We count on ourselves discriminating and our neighbors being discriminating when it comes to making the right kinds of moral decisions. It takes a power of discrimination to know the difference between right and wrong. Wrongful discrimination is a sin, but failure to discriminate would be anarchy and insanity. The reality is that one of the arguments being made very convincingly in the public square is that we shouldn't discriminate. We need to counter that with a very clear and sound verdict. You'll continue to discriminate. The question it all comes down to is this. Is this new ground of discrimination more righteous, more true, more healthy, more reasonable, or not? And that's where we need to direct this discussion. But in our current cultural context, that's going to be a very difficult fight. Next, shifting to what our entertainment culture tells us about ourselves, Alessandra Stanley, writing in her column, that is the Television Review column, in the New York Times last Saturday, writes an article on, quote, the fun of having a single parent, end quote. As she writes, NBC is on a love campaign. The network anointed the sweet-natured Jimmy Fallon as host of The Tonight Show on Monday. Over the weekend, NBC is introducing 2 feel-good sitcoms that examine the healing properties of broken homes, end quote. I read that exactly as she wrote it. Let me go back and read that last sentence. These are feel-good sitcoms that examine the healing properties of broken homes. I think you're interested in this. I know I am. What is she writing about? She writes, about a boy, that's the name of a program, which debuts on Saturday after the Olympics, revolves around a callow, womanizing bachelor in San Francisco who befriends the lonely 11-year-old son of the single woman next door. It's a rosier American version of the Hugh Grant movie, the same title, which was based on a Nick Hornby novel. The other show is entitled Growing Up Fisher. It began last Sunday. It's told as a memoir. The narrative looks back at the period when he was 11 and his blind father moved out seeking a divorce. It's not as traumatic as it sounds, she writes. The pilot quickly establishes that the family remains loving and in some ways grows even closer after the separation. Both shows, she writes, which will be regularly seen on Tuesdays, are well-written and actually quite engaging. But what is most interesting is the focus on the brighter side of splitting up. Alexander Stanley says this is a very important cultural moment, and I think she's exactly right. Our entertainment culture tells us a great deal about ourselves. What we laugh at, what we find interesting and compelling, the storylines that have our attention. This is what tells us who we are or who we expect to be, who we want to be. And what we're looking at now is the reality that NBC is debuting not one but two shows that argue that the bright side of life is in a single-parent home, in the aftermath of the breakup of a marriage. Alexander Stanley writes, back in the 1970s, economic adversity and shared hardship tightened bonds on sentimental series like Little House on the Prairie or The Waltons. Nowadays, children become better people by watching their parents live apart, end quote. It's hard to imagine from a Christian worldview perspective a sentence that is laden with more meaning than this. And here it is in a television review in last Saturday's edition of the New York Times. Alexander Stanley goes on and writes, quote, "That's partly a narrative necessity. There's not a lot of comic material or dramatic tension in a traditional family unit that is stable. But it could also be a touch of magical thinking. Television executives seem eager to make the case that divorce doesn't damage children and in some cases improves them," end quote. That's a stunningly significant paragraph. NBC, she says, or at least NBC executives, seem to think that divorce is not only not a bad thing, but can actually be a good thing. And that children who have had the benefit of two parents may actually be better off and happier when their parents divorce and they're living with only one parent. Later in her article, she writes, "Every generation has its formative crisis. NBC would like to think that the post-baby boomers are molded not by war or economic calamity, but by their parents' breakups," end quote. A couple of interesting insights from her article. She says something here that actually Tolstoy said in his own way more than a century earlier. He said, "All happy families are the same, but all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way." And what he was referring to there is that it's hard to write a great novel about a happy family. The tension, the drama, the tragedy, the heartbreak comes in the anxiety of a breakup, of a trauma, of tension, of turmoil, of a divorce or adultery or some other story. And that's true when you think about great literature through the ages. All happy families, said Tolstoy, are the same. That's why it's hard to come up with a storyline. But that's the point, isn't it? We don't want our children to be formed within the context of a crisis. We don't want them to live with uncertainty about their attachments and those who love them and care for them. In other words, we actually want our children to have very boring lives if they're measured against the great works of literature, or for that matter, what now amounts to the sitcoms on NBC. And the other very interesting thing about this, of course, is that, as Alexander Stanley suggests rather implicitly in this article, divorce is now so widespread in many communities, perhaps especially among those who are the cultural creatives in this sense, that they've actually been formed by it in such a way that they say, look, we turned out all right. It wasn't that bad. It's a very interesting cultural moment, and it's an interesting place for this argument to emerge. Right here in the television review of the New York Times is a loud announcement that the world has changed on marriage, but in this case, not about same-sex marriage, but about marriage as leading to an inevitable divorce that actually serves as liberation, making it even better for the lives of children. I don't think, by the way, that Alexander Stanley believes that's true. I think that's why she wrote her article. Actually, why else would she have written it? If NBC's point is transparent and clear and uncontroversial, it wouldn't require a news story on the front of the entertainment section of the Saturday edition of the New York Times. In its own strange way, what this article tells us is that a moral revolution has happened, and it is far more costly than those who have experienced it might even yet recognize. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.